Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome, everybody. Eddie Trunk here with you, and it's time for another edition of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday via PodcastOne.com and iTunes. Thank you for downloading, streaming, and connecting. Remember, if you're shopping on Amazon, be sure to go to Amazon.com/shop/Eddie Trunk to begin all your shopping needs. That's Amazon.com/shop/Eddie Trunk. You'll see some stuff handpicked there on the homepage by me, and then go on to any other areas of the Amazon site. And anything else you want to buy, just ask that you always start at Amazon.com/shop/Eddie Trunk. Interesting, funny note here. The opening theme music, as you know or may not know, for this podcast was done by Mark Slaughter. A couple weeks ago, I was in Tulsa, hosted a Slaughter show at the IDL Ballroom. And somebody, a very astute listener to the Eddie Trunk Podcast, came up to me and said, "Hey, is Slaughter going to perform the podcast theme tonight?" And it took me a second to figure out what the heck he was talking about. And then, of course, I remembered that Mark does that music. So shout out to Mark and shout out to that listener for knowing that that was Mark Slaughter, which I've mentioned a number of times, that does the open theme to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. I'm sure very high among his lists of accolades in his career. Speaking of the IDL Ballroom, I'm going to be back there in Tulsa to host LA Guns on April 13th. Hope to see you there. One of many shows, many appearances coming up. I'll run them down for you real quick. If you're in the New York City area, hosting a record release party at Arlene Grocery in New York City on March 24th with the band Crimshaw. Then coming up, I'll be at the guitar. These just came in, by the way. These are new additions for the Dallas area. And if you're in that area of the country, please come see me. We got two great events going on. First, March 29th, McKinney, Texas, the Guitar Sanctuary. It's a really cool, great guitar store with a performance area attached to it. I've done it before. I'm going to be doing my Q&A speaking show, Stump the Trunk, all live from Guitar Sanctuary, March 29th. That's a Thursday night, 8 p.m. sharp. There is a ticket you need to purchase. You can do it off of the link on the homepage of eddietrunk.com or go to the Guitar Sanctuary's website in McKinney, Texas, or just go to the Guitar Sanctuary in McKinney and grab your tickets. I think it's not even $20, if that, to get in. And listen to this. Everybody who buys a ticket and comes to my Q&A Stump the Trunk show, the ticket holders, you guys get free beer. Free beer included with the price of the ticket. How the hell can you beat that? It's going to be a lot of fun doing a speaking show with a bunch of people drunk in the audience. Hope to see you there. March 29th, McKinney, Texas, Guitar Sanctuary, 8 p.m. Haven't done a Q&A speaking show in a long time. Free beer, maybe some live music surprises as well. Then the next day, March 30th in McKinney, back at Guitar Sanctuary, doing my Sirius XM volume show live from the Guitar Sanctuary from 1 to 3 local time. My guest sitting in with me for that show will be guitarist John Five, and we will do a free-for-all Friday. So if you come down, maybe you'll be live on the air asking some questions on my volume show. It will be a live Sirius XM broadcast. March 30th, Guitar Sanctuary again, McKinney, Texas, from 1 to 3. That is free to get in. It is not a performance. It is not a meet and greet. John Five is playing that night, later that night, at Trees in Dallas. This is simply a chance to watch the live broadcast, maybe ask a question on the air. Thursday night is when we all hang, when I do my show, and we do Q&A, Stump the Trunk, prizes, and the whole deal. That's a ticketed event. March 29th, March 30th, that afternoon, is just the radio broadcast. Hope to see you if you're in the Dallas area for two great events at the Guitar Sanctuary in McKinney, Texas. Links, more information on the homepage of eddietrunk.com. Then April 13th, as I mentioned, IDL Ballroom hosting LA Guns. April 22nd, Proof Rooftop Lounge hosting Tom Kiefer. Then we got M3 coming up. Then we got the Ride for Ronnie charity concert coming up in Encino. Then we got Rocklahoma. Then we got Striper back in Tulsa on May 30th. The schedule is stacked. Hope to see you out at these shows. Please check the homepage of my website for more information. And follow on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Eddie Trunk Twitter, where I would be the most active and most up to the second for your news and info. Also excited, I'm headed to Mexico this weekend, the Cancun area. I'm going to be filming the next episode of my brand new TV series coming soon to Access TV called Trunk Fest, covering music festivals, covering a festival with Zac Brown in Riviera Maya, Mexico this weekend. We're going to get all these shows done. Then you're going to see this series roll out later this year. Excited to be ramping up again, shooting new shows for the Access TV show coming soon. More information about its premiere when I can share and when I have that information. Remember, hear me daily on Sirius XM 106 volume, live from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, replaying every night, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, and always on demand on the Sirius XM app, doing rock talk every single day, calls, interviews, and more. Most of the interviews you hear on the Eddie Trunk podcast are courtesy and originated on that radio show. So, needless to say, as usual, a lot going on, schedule stacked, a lot of great stuff going on, and follow along and keep up on social media for all the info and updates. We have to get right to our interviews because I got two for you this week. Three guests over the course of two interviews. First up, one of my all-time favorite guitar players from one of my all-time favorite bands, former UFO guitarist Michael Schenker. Michael Schenker currently out on tour with the Michael Schenker Fest that is happening right now across the U.S., getting rave reviews, touring with three of his former lead vocalists, and everybody is raving about the show. 2.5 hour show Michael Schenker is putting in. We talk about it on the eve of the tour. We also talk about the potential for a UFO reunion with the 40th anniversary of Strangers in the Night and a whole lot more. Then the second interview on this week's podcast, legendary producer Eddie Kramer and the man who controls the Jimi Hendrix archives, John McDermott. Both of them together talking Jimi Hendrix and talking about the new Hendrix album that just came out. A lot of fun to talk to Jimi Hendrix, who engineered the Eddie Kramer, who engineered the Jimi Hendrix records. And that is the second interview, along with John McDermott, on this week's podcast. So, a lot to get to. Let's get into it right after this.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Let me tell you guys about 4hymns.com. This is a pretty amazing site for guys out there. A one-stop shop for any issues for us guys. We're talking hair loss, skin care, sexual wellness. This site connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions for hair loss or any other guy's issues. These are well-known, real solutions, folks. Name brand prescriptions help you keep your hair. There's no snake oil pills, gas station counter supplements, prescription solutions. That's what this is, backed by science. This is the real stuff. There's no waiting rooms. You have to go to the doctor's office and be awkward about what you're there for. You can save hours, and it's so convenient. Go to 4hymns.com. It's easy. You answer a few quick questions. The doctor will review and prescribe for you. And the products, they are shipped directly to your door, real products. Order now. My listeners get a trial month of Hymns for just $5 today. right now while supplies last. See the website for details. This would cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy. You got to try it. Go to forhims.com/trunk, T-R-U-N-K. That's forhims, forhims.com/trunk. Do it. It'll help you out. It's the great way to go. forhims.com/trunk, forhims.com/trunk. Any guy's issues, balding issues, you heard me. You heard what I said. We know we're talking about skincare, hair loss, sexual issues. forhims.com/trunk. Check it out.
Hey, podcast listener. This is Rob Cisternino. I'm the Rob, and Rob has a podcast, and the new season of Survivor is just getting started, and we've got new episodes for you 5 days a week. Join us for interviews with your favorite past Survivor players and this season's losers right after they get their torch snuffed. Listen free to Rob Has a Podcast, exclusively available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. And if you like the show, why not share it with a friend or leave us a rating and review on iTunes?
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Okay, we're back with this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast. First of two interviews this week, we check in with Michael Schenker. Michael gave me a call as soon as he got into the U.S. the day he was kicking off the tour he is currently on here in the U.S. called the Michael Schenker Fest. And with that, one of my all-time favorites, a guitar hero to many, the great Michael Schenker. What's going on, Michael? How are you, my friend?
Hi, Eddie. I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Welcome to the U.S. When did you get here?
On the 2nd.
Oh, okay. So were you putting in a little rehearsal time, getting ready for the kickoff tonight?
Yes, yes. We are ready to rock.
Well, I got to tell you, man, I am extremely excited that you have brought the Michael Schenker Fest to America. I saw the Japanese DVD that you released, and when you did it in Japan, and the first thing I said to myself was, my gosh, I would have went to Japan to see something like that. Now I don't have to go quite as far because you're here touring with it in the U.S. For people that don't know what this is, Michael, explain what you're doing right now on this tour.
Yeah, it's actually the first time we're showing up with four singers, and it's actually the last concert we did with three singers. What you were talking about, which is on the DVD in Japan, was with three singers, and then we finished the tour in the UK, and then we, in the meantime, we also recorded a brand new album, Resurrection, with four singers. I invited Dougie White, and he is also a member of the Michael Schenker Fest now, and we are touring. This is going to be the first time here in the States. You guys are going to see this for the first time with four singers, the exact same lineup as the brand new release, Resurrection, which came out on the 2nd of March. And it's already number one in America, in Japan. It's already number four in Germany. It's voted one of the most the album of the year in many different countries in Europe, and we did a listening party, and that was the result of it. And we are actually doing a 2.5-hour set, and it's going to be classics, new stuff, old stuff, instrumentals. I mean, something for everybody, and it's going to be with four singers. It's the three original singers from the 80s. Gary Barton, Graham Bonnet, and Robin McCauley, and the latest thing I did with Francis Buchholz and Herman Rabel, who used to be with the Scorpions, which was the Michael Schenker's Temple of Rock. I invited Dougie White, and he's going to be part of it, and it's going to be a long show, which will be over very quickly, because, you know, those four singers, they all sound different, and for the hardcore fan, you know, to see everything on one stage in one night, and especially also on the album, you know, it's very entertaining, especially like songs like The Warrior, where all the singers sing together, and, you know, the hardcore fan, even without the footage, this must be Robin, this must be Gary. I can imagine it being very exciting, and also for the newcomer to see all of this, how it might have been in the past. You know, my energy that I spread all over the place for the last 30, 40 years. I collected it all together, and you know, how it was originally recorded, how it was originally, the chemistry, the way it was when it happened in the past, and, you know, putting it all together and in on one stage is like having one super band, you know, and it's fantastic.
I got to tell you, I think it's really cool, Michael, because this is actually a couple different things. As you mentioned, you've got Gary Barden, who sang on those early records, which I love. You've got Graham Bonnet, who sang on Assault Attack, which I love, and the same rhythm section from Assault Attack, which is tremendous. And then Robin McCauley, who you had a great commercial success with. So you've got, you're celebrating those periods of your career with the singers who actually sang on those records, which is amazing. But the other thing, and you mentioned this, is it's not only about the past, because you have made a great new record with all those guys included called Resurrection. A little while ago, we played a little bit of the song Warrior. So this is very much about celebrating the past and your history, but it's also with an eye towards the future as well, because the new things you're doing are a component of this as well, right?
Yeah, by adding Dougie White to it, I'm also presenting the present. But also because we made a record, it's all past and current now, because Dougie is singing only Temple of Rock material. So he is, you know, everybody singing their own stuff. Of course, we're going to be, you know, it's the 40th anniversary of Strangers in the Night. So we're going to be playing that stuff too. And that's going to be, you know, another highlight. And it's shared by all the members in my band.
Well, it's incredible. There's a bunch of things I want to talk to you about, and I know, you know, I want to ask you. So on the record, Resurrection, which I just got, and the packaging is tremendous, because I've got the two disc that has the DVD of all the bonus content, and then the record, and then the photos and everything. It's fantastic. And you also, and I remembered this because, of course, I had a role in it, when you and Kirk Hammett jammed on my TV show, I noticed you have Kirk, and I know he was very excited about this. Kirk made a guest appearance on the record, right?
Yeah, it's your fault.
Well, I'm happy to take the blame for that one. Thank you.
Okay.
So how did that come to be? Was it because you guys jammed on the show and stayed in touch? And I know he's a huge fan of yours. Did he reach out to you? Did you contact him?
Yeah, I mean, you made it possible, you know, with him and his management to arrange to invite me to your show. We jammed together. Kirk got that out of his system, you know, to meet and speak and play together. So, you know, and then he came to jam with us a few days later somewhere. And alive, and so basically Kirk, the fan, has become a friend and plays in the biggest band in the world. I said, Kirk, you want to do it? And he says, yes.
Yeah, he texted me and he said, dude, I'm on Michael Schenker's record. This is incredible. So he was, does it amaze you, Michael, after all these decades of playing guitar, when you run into people like that, as you just said, Kirk Hammett, a guitar player, one of the biggest bands in the world, and he's such a fan of yours. I know you don't even listen to other music. You just live in your world and do your thing. So does it surprise you when you realize the impact you made like that?
Yeah, absolutely, Eddie. I didn't even focus on being famous when I started playing guitar. I just enjoyed playing, you know. I became famous by itself. It was never even a concept of mine. And so when it all happened, and I found out the impact I had many, many years later, you know, I mean, late 80s or something like that, when everything started dribbling in from people telling me all of these things, you know, I was amazed. I mean, I had no idea. And you know, all of a sudden I was getting awards and stuff like that. So it's unbelievable, you know. I mean, those three episodes of my life, you know, they make all complete sense to me now, you know. Since I'm in my third part of my life, I look back, I can see very clearly those three different stages and what the purpose were of them.
And I don't think people listening would believe this, but I know this is true because you said it more than one time that over the last like 40 years, you do not listen to any other music because you want what you generate and create to be pure. You don't want it to be influenced by anything else. I think that's really fascinating. I don't know anybody that has ever said or done that before. Was that a conscious thing that you made when you were much younger to say, I'm going to tune everything else out so that I can only create from within and not be influenced by outside sources?
Yeah, somehow I had that inner knowledge that well, you know, that's what I need to do. I mean, for me, it's the art of lead guitar with pure self-expression. That's what calls me to be. And I have been very firm about that for 43 years now. And, you know, and as a result of that, I've become a trend maker and have actually, in the 70s impacted a lot of different musicians over the years. But only because of that. I mean, anybody can actually do it if you have that kind of a concept. Another thing is, Macaulay, Schenker, I mean, actually, I have not even performed for over 30 years the Macaulay, Schenker stuff, and I haven't even performed other than just the one song I saw the track of the record that I recorded with Graham Bonnet, which, by the way, at that time, Chris's Records, they were moving office. They didn't even promote it. Graham only appeared for 15 minutes, and then he disappeared. And so that music has not in the slightest been even overexposed or not even, we haven't even scratched the surface. So basically I'm coming with something old that is brand new, if you know what I mean.
Sure I do, because I love the Assault Attack record, and I never got to see much of, if any of that material performed live.
Yeah, it only became the musician's favorite because it never got promoted. It's the weirdest thing, you know, it's the weirdest thing. But now, and I never touched it, you know, and that is so weird because now we're doing the Michael Schenker Fest, and it's the old stuff that is actually brand new because it has never been performed with the original lineup except for the McCordy stuff. But not when I, for the last, say, for since 90, we split up in 90. So that's like almost 30 years.
Yeah, so this is a great time for you, Michael, because I think it's wonderful. I mean, this really is very much a celebration of your incredible history under the MSG banner. And I know you're going to, as you said, you're going to work in some UFO stuff now, and you've got your one foot forward as well. It's not all about the what was behind. Now you've made this great record with these guys. I mean, I think it's wonderful where you're at in your career right now. You know, I it's really great to see. It's great vibes. And I'll tell you what, I don't know. Most guitar players I talk to, they can't deal with one singer in their band. I don't know how you're dealing with four.
Yeah, and you know, here's another thing is, you know, this is the 40th anniversary of Strangers in the Night. Who knows? Maybe even Phil Mock pops up and sings a couple of UFO songs here and there with the Michael Schenker Fest. In 2019, I'm celebrating 50 years of recording with Klaus Meine, the first ever written song I did when I was 15 years old, In Search of Peace of Mind. I wrote that with Klaus, and for some reason, the Scorpions were credited for it, but it was actually my music. That was the first song I ever wrote in my mother's kitchen. And so who knows, maybe by the time we reach 2019, maybe even Klaus is going to be popping up and sing a couple of songs with me. So the possibilities are, you know, like that. It's not a must, but it's all possibilities. And then we can call it the ultimate Michael Schenker Fest.
Oh, my gosh. Have you talked to Klaus or Phil Mogg about possibly coming out to anything?
No, I think I'm just spreading the possibilities, you know. So
yeah.
Maybe it reaches them and they go, well, maybe not such a bad idea. Who knows?
Well, you know, you're. It's amazing that you are. It's great that you're celebrating these periods of your career because it's some of my favorite stuff that you did ever. But you mentioned the 40th anniversary of Strangers in the Night, which is pretty much my favorite album of all time. And I've said many times to people, I will go anywhere in the world for one last time to see the band that made that record play it again live. Is that something you'd like to do to celebrate that record? Has there been any talk about that?
That is the talk about it. I don't even think it's possible unless it's with original members, and I wouldn't join their organization either. You know, I think the only way and the closest you get it, I mean, Phil Mark and Michael Schenker is more UFO than UFO will ever be, the way they are moving about at this point in time. So, you know, by having Phil Mark on stage, that is UFO more than what is UFO actually, what Phil is running around with a name. It's not even close to anything that Phil and I could do by ourselves, you know. So, but, you know, you don't know what's going on with Pete. You don't know what's going on with anybody, really. And the fact is, I mean, you know, Strangers in the Night was, I mean, it's basically a collection of my personal development as a guitar player, you know, from Lonesome Crow and then to through a Phenomenon, Force Fit, No Heavy Petting, Lights Out, that was our first hit, then Obsession and Strangers in the Night. Those were the years, 8 years of developing as a guitarist, up to the year of 1978, when I was 23 years old. That's when I tasted fame and success at its highest, and I was able to make the choice if I wanted to hold on to fame and stay up there, or if I wanted to start my second chapter, which the black and white guitar marks, and experiment with music and do things the way I see it and my own timing, and deal with life and learn all the things that were there. You know, I wrote the song Into the Arena. That's basically what my second part of life was all about, the second and the most rewarding, because that's where I learned everything, and that's why I can enjoy myself today, and that's why I can celebrate today. It's because of the middle years.
Michael Schenker and the Michael Schenker Fest are on tour in the U.S. The tour starts tonight in Silver Springs, Maryland at the Fillmore and ends at the Ritz in Tampa, Florida on April 3rd. There's stops in Dallas, San Antonio, Denver, Vegas, Anaheim, Seattle, Milwaukee. There's a bunch of shows. Just go to Michael's website, which is michaelschenkerhimself.com, and see the dates and links to buy tickets and all that sort of stuff. Well, Michael, I got to tell you, I wanted you to check in for a few minutes. I know the tour is starting, and I know you have a lot going on. I'm definitely going to try to catch you at a show, hopefully this Saturday in New York. And I think this is really special what you're doing. And I got to tell you, as far as UFO, I mean, the current band, Andy is still there and Paul is still there. So all we'd have to do is get you there and see if we could get Pete to get it together. And I hear he's doing better. Maybe there's hope. Maybe there's a chance.
I leave it up to the universe, okay? I'm open to anything that makes sense, but, you know, for now, it's for me, it's the Michael Schenker Fest, and it's my development. It's about the art of lead guitar playing, and you know, those years with UFO were my musical contribution to the world, unconsciously. In the 70s, that had so much impact, which I had no clue about, but it was created for the 80s, and the 80s musicians, they watered it down, they made it more commercial, they made it attractive to a wide mass of audience, and we know with bands like AC/DC, do you know, I wonder how many people picked up an instrument because they saw AC/DC and went, wow, this is so easy. If they can do it, I can do it. You know? It had to happen that way, you know, because nobody's interested in wanting to do something that looks almost like untouchable. So it had to go through the ages process. People had to, you know, it had to be made attractive to, and that's why everybody has an assignment. Everybody has a place in life, and it's effective in different times and places. And so, you know, I was there in the beginning, I will be there in the end, and in the middle, that was when all the other stuff was going on, when everybody was selling platinum albums.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, it's an amazing career. It's an amazing amount of tremendous music you've given us over the decades. And I want to tell everybody the stuff you're still making now is great, because that track Warrior and some of the stuff on this new album is really, really good. Michael Schenker Fest, the album is called Resurrection, and go see one of the all time greats out there celebrating his incredible career. It's I can tell from watching the DVD, it's very special.
Yeah, I must add to that. And it's not just me who's celebrating. It's actually the whole band, you know. It's like we're all basically in the same boat. And the best of all is actually the audience are celebrating that as well.
So oh, yeah.
It is all together. I mean, it makes more than sense. That whole thing is a complete, is a journey almost completed.
Yeah, it really is. It's great stuff. Michael, say hello to everybody. I hope to see you this weekend. Safe travels out there on the road.
Thank you so much, Eddie. Keep on walking. See you later.
You too. Take care. Thank you to Michael Shanker for checking in and being a part of the Eddie Trunk podcast this week. Again, check out Michael Shanker, currently out on tour doing the Michael Shanker Fest. All right, we'll come back and we will be joined by Eddie Kramer, legendary producer who engineered the Hendrix Records, which is what he's going to be talking about, this new Jimi Hendrix record, and the man who controls and runs the Jimi Hendrix Archives, John McDermott. Fascinating interview. That's next on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Here's some useful car tips that you might not be aware of. For instance, a coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior. Removing excess weight from your car, that'll improve your gas mileage. And you can place your key fob to your chin, and that helps increase its range. It's pretty weird, right? Well, here's another tip you also might not know about, and that's that TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. True Car isn't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with True Car, users can see what others paid so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with a True Car certified dealer. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Hey, humans. David Smalley here from the Dogma Debate Podcast, right here on Podcast One, where we talk about all the things you're not supposed to discuss at work: religion, politics, abortion, racism, slavery. And that's only when we open the Bible. We discuss Islam, Islamophobia. What does that even mean? We chat with vegans, animal rights activists, and even visit factory farms to see it for ourselves. I invite people from multiple backgrounds to convert me into their worldview. But as long as they're okay with being respectfully challenged, you better bring your evidence. And I never lose sight of how both the left and the right are seeming to lose their minds. So basically, we're solving all the world's problems right here on Dogma Debate. And you've been missing it. Download Dogma Debate on iTunes, Stitcher, or PodcastOne.com.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Double dip this week on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Now we get into our second interview. Eddie Kramer, a guy that I've known for over 30 years, ever since I worked with him on the Ace Frehley solo records back in the mid-80s. He dropped by. Of course, Eddie has done so much in his career, and we will do a full in-depth interview with him somewhere down the line. But he was in to promote the brand new Jimi Hendrix record, which has just come out. Also joining Eddie Kramer for this interview is John McDermott, who's the guy behind Experience Hendrix and really the Jimi Hendrix catalog manager. Fascinating conversation about one of the true icons in rock, Jimi Hendrix, by Eddie Kramer and John McDermott. Enjoy. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you. Nice to see you too, Eddie Trunk.
And it's good to have John McDermott with us as well, who is, John, what would be your official title in the Hendrix land? Catalog manager?
Yeah,
what is it?
I manage the Jimi Hendrix music catalog and am involved with all the production of everything all to do with Jimi.
And we were talking a little while ago, you're also very instrumental in the Experience Hendrix shows, which I've had a chance to see some, and yeah, are awesome, awesome tributes to Jimi every time I've seen them. More coming on that?
Yeah, the tour is something I started to kind of celebrate Jimmy's music. It you know, from as a fan, it should be about not just what we do with the releases, sharing the music, but you know, the live show allows not only myself but all these great artists to collaborate together and celebrate Jimmy's music. So we're looking perhaps at 2019 as an opportunity to get back out there and, you know, get the fans excited about hearing Jimmy.
Imagine it's not hard finding guitar players that want to play Jimi Hendrix on the road, right?
It's funny. Kenny Wayne Shepherd came up with this term. He calls it summer camp for the artists because, you know, it's a very communal thing. We all ride together, and they get to hang out together. And all of the pressure that's in their normal career doesn't exist. They're able to just, like, say, hey, this is my favorite Jimmy. I get a chance to play with guys I don't normally get to play with. All the band politics, management, record company stuff, that goes out the window for a month, and it's really a lot of fun.
I was going to say, it's just the biggest battle must be trying to figure out who gets to play what. You know, how many people, I'm getting Little Wing. No, I'm getting Little Wing, and they must duke it out, you know?
You know what's funny, though? People like to go deep. Like, when we had Steve Vai, he was like, can I play Midnight? You know, like, so there are certain tracks where people really like, Kebmo wanted to play My Friend.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's interesting that given the vibe of the presentation, a lot of the artists enjoy the ability to do something which isn't part of kind of the, you know, the five most famous Hendrix songs. I mean, you know, we really present the show not as this freewheeling jam, but as like a really, you know, organized, arranged, you know, this is something where you're seeing these artists not just wing it and, you know, all of a sudden somebody steps out and is going to start playing this long solo. No, I mean, this is their song. This is the musicians they chose. So that's why it's fun for them.
Yeah. We're going to talk about, incredibly, a brand new Jimi Hendrix record in a second called Both Sides of the Sky that's just come out. But before we do, from both of you guys, starting with you, Eddie, where is your, like, John, I'm sure you came into the Hendrix world a little later in the history, but Eddie, you engineered and worked with Jimmy on so many of these recordings.
Yeah, I did all of the first four albums anyway.
Where did tell the audience that doesn't know your history with Hendrix and how it came to be that you, who I imagine were very young at the time, worked with Jimi Hendrix? Like, how did you become his guy? And here you are to this day, basically for a long time now, you know, carrying his legacy forward with the, I mean, I'm sure that's a great responsibility for you. I mean, you're the guy to talk to about Hendrix. How did it start for you?
I was this young engineer at Olympic Studios in London. And it was 1967, and I'd heard about Jimmy. I mean, who hadn't in London? Because the year before, in 66, he had come there and established himself as the guy. I mean, if you can imagine Jimi Hendrix jamming and playing in London for the first time, and Eric Clapton and Pete Townshend and all these people coming to look at him. And Clapton said afterwards, hey, I can't play him. I just let him do it because he was just so overwhelmed with how great Jimmy was. Jimmy does his first single, Hey Joe, big hit. After that, Wind Cries Mary. And during that latter period of 66, he and Chas Chandler, who was his producer, they're trying different studios. They're trying to figure out how to get this thing to sound right. I mean, it was okay. It sounded decent, I guess. But they were a little unhappy. Then they'd heard about the new Olympic. And so January of 67, I get the phone call from the studio manager, start recording Jimi Hendrix, here we go. And I meet him for the first time, and I'll never forget it. Just him walking in and just sitting very quietly in the corner, not saying anything. He had this little white raincoat, just he was pulling it around. It was bloody cold in London at that time. And then the big roadie comes in with all the gear. Hey, mate, where do you want this lot? Oh, okay, over there. Thank you very much. And we set up Mitch's drums and Noel's bass. Put mics in front of everything, and I ran into the control room and started to get some sounds and said, Jimmy, come in and have a quick listen. I just taped something for him. And he came in and I hit the playback button and he went, yeah, okay. And he gave me the sort of little nod, wink, half smile as he, I like to think that was his nod of approval. And he said, well, check this out. And he went back out into the studio and started twiddling with the amp and with the pedals and fiddling about. And he said, right. And then I hit record again and recorded a whole bunch more. So we kept trying to top each other. Every time he would improve his thing, I would improve my thing.
Oh.
And that started it. And we just sort of clicked. And he had this wonderful, wicked, sly sense of humor. And it was just a joy to work with the man.
What was the very first exchange you had with him? Was it right there in that studio?
Mm-hmm.
Was that the first handshake and the first hello? And
yeah, and imagine standing in the studio for the first time and hearing that amp. It was just like, oh my God, how the hell do you record this thing? But, you know, you figure it out.
But he clearly saw very quickly and heard something very quickly in you that he had not maybe gotten on his previous recordings to say, whoa, this guy's on the same wavelength. He's bringing something to my music that I hadn't captured yet, to have had the run you had with him, to be his guy. I mean, that's a very special thing.
It was such a thrill to work with the man, because we definitely clicked. There's no question. I can't say I was ever on the same level with Jimi Hendrix. That would be silly. But I think I could interpret what he was saying and what he was thinking. I try to step one piece at a time. Okay, Jimmy's going to do this. Okay, I better get ahead of that and reinterpret what he was trying to do. And Chaz Chandler was wonderful. He said, the rules are, there are no bloody rules. And it just gave us the opportunity to kick down the doors and just experiment and go wild and crazy. I remember taking odd pieces of tape and wrapping it around the capstan of the tape machine and hitting record for the reverb, so the reverb went and Jimmy said, yeah, that's cool, man, that's cool. You know, he loved anything that would help him express the sounds that he heard in his head. And the classic one was phasing. He had never heard phasing before, and one day I sat
explain and, to the audience that doesn't know phasing in layman's terms.
Phasing is like this thing that goes where the sounds cross over, and it's like listening to shortwave radio, but imagine applying that sound to guitars. It's mammoth, you know. It's just the most scary thing you can imagine. So I sat him down one day and I said, Jimmy, check this out. We just figured out how to do phasing, which involved two tape machines and motors and oscillators and all that kind of stuff. And he sat there on the couch right behind me, and we hit play on this was Axis Bowler's Love. And in the middle of Axis, you hear the drums come in. Mitch's goes, and as that's coming in, that's where you hear the phasing, and it just blasts from side to side. And Jimmy's sitting on the couch behind me, and he goes, oh my God. He grabs his head with his two hands, and he falls over onto the floor, collapses on the floor in a heap, and he's going, oh man, that sound, where did you get that sound from? Oh my God. Play it again. It was in my dream. I've never heard a sound about that. I dreamt that sound. We play it again. Oh man, he was still freaking out. He says, hey man, I want that sound on everything. True story.
Amazing. Well, and John, for you, your history with Hendrix, because the both of you guys, and again, we're going to talk about this new record in a second, but the both of you guys have really for many years now been the people that have carried the flag for Hendrix. You know, Eddie from the musical perspective of being the guy that was there and his right hand when he was making it, to what you've done in keeping the catalog going and all the things you've done. So where do you come into the picture?
Well, certainly starting as a fan, and then I was a journalist. I was writing about music, and I was writing an article about Jimi Hendrix because I was disappointed with those records that had come out in the middle 70s.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking,
for you,
I think, Nine to the Universe was the record that really kind of spurred me to say, wait a minute, what's going on? How can this be really all of what is left for Jimi Hendrix? Mm-hmm. Just as a fan hearing bootlegs, you knew there were better things, I felt, that were there. So I reached out to Eddie, and you know, we just had an immediate rapport, and we were going over things. But Eddie was interesting. He said, you know, my relationship with Jimi Hendrix was really strong, but you know, Jimmy compartmentalized a lot of things in his life, so we had a very intense connection in the studio. But to tell a story, you'd have to set the record straight. And that kind of became this mantra for us. We said, you know what, let's make a documentary film. Well, we were blocked by Alan Douglas at that time, you know, from doing that. So we said, all right, we'll turn it into a book. So we wrote the book, Hendrix Setting the Record Straight. And then from there, you know, Eddie and I just said, let's do something really good. Let's leave Jimi Hendrix in a better place. We came up with the idea of doing the Stone Free tribute record back in 93.
Right, remember that.
And that, you know, it was a very successful record, and we established a scholarship in Jimmy's name at the United Negro College Fund. So it was really a wonderful thing. And we both kind of went back to our own careers doing what we did. Well, at the time, I learned of the litigation that Jimmy's father, Al Hendrix, was in. And I reached out to his lawyers and said, look, you don't know me from Adam, but that man owns everything. Don't sell him out. Really look after him. And they were like, okay, well, thank you. And, you know, it's like, okay, at least I did that. Well, they called back in a month later and said, you know, you're on to something. Would you mind coming out and helping us and working with that? So I came out, and the Hendrix family asked me to kind of stay on and help them. And
you know
and
why?
From there, because, it's become the greatest job in the world.
Because he knew where all the bodies were buried.
So, you know, one of the things that we wanted to do once we started, Eddie, was to, you know, to share this music with fans, but to really kind of fix it and put it in a way that you could really appreciate it. I mean, nothing articulates Hendrix better than Hendrix. He does all the heavy lifting for you.
Right.
And what's interesting about Jimmy is that you have this, everybody, each of us has this direct connection. There's something about Hendrix that goes deep in you.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what we felt we had to make sure the fans were able to do, whether you were there when he was alive or whether you're just hearing it for the first time now. Because you dip your toe in the water, he's got you. It's good.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice way to get into talking about the latest project that you guys have worked on, which is beyond, you know, something nobody would have ever, I think would have expected in 2018, and that is a new Jimi Hendrix record, Both Sides of the Sky, which is available now. So is this let the audience know exactly what this is. This is all previously unheard material, Eddie and John?
Yeah, just about. 10 of the 13.
Yeah, 10 of the 13 are previously unreleased.
And where do you, like, you hear bands all the time talk about the archives, the vaults. Is that essentially, like, where is that for Jimi Hendrix? Like, where do you physically find this stuff?
Well, I wish in some way that there was a vault that we could go to when we first started this. But the problem was is that in all of the years after Jimmy's death, you know, once Eddie had, you know, effectively said, okay, I've worked on the records that I've worked on, I'm going to my own career, I'm doing what I'm doing. Well, then at that point, it went into all kinds of crazy directions. And then you had people that had, they were held on to tapes because they were owed money or there was some other consideration that was never met. And so it became part of an ongoing effort starting in 95 to start to reel this in, solve these problems. You know, we had one guy who had 66 multi-track tapes of Jimi Hendrix that he was holding over an unpaid
phone bill. Now, when you say one guy, would this be somebody that owns a studio or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you're almost doing detective work at this point.
It's not almost. It is at a constant detection.
Does this guy, say this guy holding these tapes because of an unpaid phone bill, right?
Yes.
Does he realize what he has?
He totally does. What was interesting is that when Al Hendrix won the case, this was a guy who Alan Douglas had taken all the tapes from Electric Lady in a Brinks truck, and they made a story about it. Some will remember there was pictures of it in Rolling Stone back in the day. And he brought it out to a studio in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and then ran up a phone bill, didn't pay it, took most of the tapes and left. Well, this guy held on to all these tapes for all these years, tried to solve it. Finally, you know, like a lot of things, put that in the back, we'll deal with it another day. He hears that Al Hendrix won his lawsuit and says, look, if you make this right, you can have everything back. So, you know, when we got that call, I couldn't drive out there fast enough.
Right.
I filled my car with these things. And the Hendrix family said to him, look, the value of that $7,000 bill is this much money in today's money. And they gave it to him, shook his hand, and we were out.
Wow.
And that's one example, Eddie, of this. I mean, I could give you 20 of them.
So is that how this new album came to be? Did Both Sides of the Sky come to be off of finding
some
Eddie,
things.
Were you must be aware, do you have a recollection of this, having recorded this stuff originally, or was there so much it's hard to remember?
Some of them I do remember, but don't forget, this is the year of this particular record, 1969. This was the year Jimmy was in the studio using it as a rehearsal room, jamming and trying to find that new direction, which he finally found. If you remember Woodstock, at the beginning of Woodstock, he says, hey man, we're nothing but a band of gypsies. That showed the direction, because 3-4 months later, at the Fillmore East here in New York, he records the band of gypsies. You know, he owed Capitol Records this album. Yep. And so you could see where that direction was going.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, this record represents Jimmy in the studio jamming, but it's captured. Thank goodness the tape was rolling, you know. And he's standing there playing. The songs are almost there. They're kind of complete, but these are the blueprints for what was going to come.
Essentially this record is the blueprint for Band of Gypsies.
I think really the three records that we've done over the last, say, 8-9 years, starting with Valleys of Neptune, then People, Hell, and Angels, and this one, this is like the best of the remaining studio work. We really can't, you know, articulate where Jimmy was going to go, because that was in his head and he was on his path. And certainly this record isn't like the lost song, the lost note, the lost shoe. There's none of that going on. This is the, you know, what we decided to do is to say, look, post Electric Ladyland, Jimmy was recording and recording and recording because he had litigation from his past when he was a sideman. That's what led to Band of Gypsies being delivered to Capitol. He just stayed in the studio recording and recording and recording. He then built Electric Lady Studios. That opens, continues recording, recording. Sadly, he dies. So all of this stuff is created, but it just hasn't been released on record yet. So what we tried to do with these three records was plan them out in such a way that with Valleys of Neptune, you're really hearing the end of the original experience. And as you move forward to People, Hell, and Angels in this, yes, you're hearing a few things by the original experience, but really more about where he was going in 69 and 70 prior to his death.
Eddie, for you, when you get a hold of this stuff, what sort of work do you need to put into it? What sort of restoration? What kind of condition are these tapes in? I imagine stuff sitting around this long, it takes quite a bit of work to get it to the point where you're ready to put it out, right?
We're very fortunate because tapes that were recorded prior to 1972 or 73 when they changed the tape formula, touch wood, boink, boink on my head, they play perfectly. So we've been able to transfer all the 16 tracks, the 8 tracks, even 12 tracks, half-inch 4 tracks, all get transferred into the digital realm.
So the earlier versions of tape held up better than a change in formulation at that point?
Do you know why?
No.
The earlier tapes, up until a certain point in the early 70s, the part of the formula was whale oil, and then they banned it, and then the tape companies had to scramble to figure out how to make a new formula. And that's why a lot of the tapes later on, you store them for a year or two and then you can't play them anymore unless you bake them. We never had a baker tape. Anyway, the rest of it was, how do you restore it? Okay, now I've transferred it from tape into Pro Tools using the Burl A to D converters, which I love to use, and it sounds just like the original tape. And then I mix it through an analog board using digital plugins and the analog equipment I have. The analog gives it the girth, the fatness. That's what we love. And the beautiful new digital plugins that we have, I can be like a surgeon and go in and just take an eighth of a dB of something and just clear the dirt around his voice, you know what I'm saying, and make it sound pristine.
Yeah, it's amazing. The record that is out now is called Both Sides of the Sky. As you mentioned, 13 tracks, 10 of which are newly released, and also something that, to my knowledge at least, there wasn't a lot of in Hendrix's career, and that's guest appearances from different people, right? So talk a little bit about who we have on this record.
Well, there's two tracks that Stephen Stills was a part of, including a version of Woodstock prior to Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young recording it. Stephen came to a Jimi Hendrix session, which incredibly had both Buddy Miles and Mitch Mitchell present, and kind of burst in and said, hey, I'm really excited about this song Joni Mitchell just wrote called Woodstock. So Jimmy takes a bass, flips it over, and says, all right, buddy, come on, let's go cut it. And boom, there it is.
There it is.
And that's it on the record.
Yeah. And Jimmy is playing almost like a session guy. He's sublimating his ego to a large extent because he just wants to play what the song needs, not being an overt sort of, oh, I don't know, I've got to be Jimi Hendrix. But it's just playing what it needs.
Blending in. Yeah. What about Manish Boy?
Well, Manish Boy is the first ever session by the Band of Gypsies. You talk about three young guys. You know, Jimmy reached out to Billy Cox, who was his buddy from the Army, and Buddy Miles, who he loved. And, you know, their common language was blues. So Jimmy did this great version, which is kind of a hybrid of the Bo Diddley and Muddy Waters version, and he just kills it.
And the other one, Things I Used to Do, Guitar Slim.
Well, that's interesting because, again, Jimmy's favorite place to hang was the Scene Club, and you know, which is, as Eddie will say, right around the corner from the record plant. And this is just another example
in
New York.
Okay,
you know, if you think about Voodoo Child from Electric Ladyland, that was the same situation. Jimmy went down to the Scene, you know, brought back Steve Winwood and Jack Cassidy, and brought him and cut that track. Same thing here. He loved Guitar Slim, was one of the legendary blues guys. If you listen to the song, Jimmy's kind of mimicking Slim's, you know, finger picking tone. And I just think it was that situation where in the Scene, people he liked got excited by. He said, come on over, man. Let's take what we're doing here and let's go record.
Any other special guests on this? Johnny Winter on this record?
That's Johnny on that track.
Johnny Winter track, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And Lonnie Youngblood, who is an old friend of Jimmy's, saxophone player and a vocalist. He had been on the Chitlin circuit with Jimmy and Curtis Knight and the Squires. And typical of Jimmy, I think when he made it, he really remembered those people who had stood by him and helped him. And so he brought back Lonnie and, you know, certainly in his Woodstock band, he brought back his old friend Larry Lee. So I think he seemed to be a very loyal guy. And those
always remembered his friends.
Yeah, always remembered his friends. And when he made it, he didn't necessarily say, hey, this guy will help me sell more records. No. I just want I want people who understand what I'm trying to do to be with me.
And Eddie, you'd be better to speak on this. Were there guitar players? What guitar players at the time did Jimmy himself look like? Respect and really like. I just read and saw a documentary on Terry Kath, the late guitar player from Chicago, who was very proud of the fact that Hendrix saw him and was like, that guy is just a whole nother, you know. Were there, so assuming Terry Kath from Chicago, were there any other guys around that time or John that you would know that he was, I mean, a guy like Johnny Winter on, you know, playing with him? I mean,
don't forget, Jimmy is famous for sitting at the feet of Buddy Guy with a little tape machine. And it said to him, hey, man, can I tape you? Would you mind? And Buddy said, sure, man. And there is an actual...
Yeah, this film of it. Sure. No, I think it's interesting. I think he was open-minded to a lot of players like Johnny Winter, like, you know, all these guys. But I think at the same time, he was a guy that dug, like, Billy Butler. He was a guy who dug Hubert Sumlin. Elmore James was one of his all-time favorites. Blues was his root music. Yeah. Like, he loved the blues. So those kind of guys, I think, were, you know. And what's sad is that had he lived, it would have been great to imagine. Can you imagine Jimi Hendrix doing something with Muddy Waters?
Well, I just said that the other day because, I don't know, a few months ago it was his birthday, and I guess he would have been 75. He's about 75.
My age.
You're 75, Eddie?
Yes, sir.
God bless you, man. You look great.
Thank you.
But he would have been 75, and I, you know, kind of a final question to both of you guys is: here we have all these great posthumous releases, and there's been tremendous videos. I know you guys have worked on too. I mean, I've watched many of them, the concerts and things. But do you think that at 75 years old, if he would have lived, what do you think Hendrix would be doing right now? Start with you, John.
Well, I mean, certainly, I think that if you think about building Electric Lady Studios. At the time of his death, the next big client that comes in is Stevie Wonder. So how can you not imagine those guys doing something? And, you know, it could have been everything. I think Steve Winwood was one of his all-time favorite musicians. No doubt they would have done something together. But you extrapolate that 40 years later, think of how much we lost.
No.
I mean, Jimmy had such an enormous impact on American music, the music of the world.
Very short time.
4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
If he had had a career like Dylan, Clapton, McCartney, all these other contemporaries of his, you would have had decades of incredible music and innovation.
Which is exactly why I bring it up, because you would think, like, going back to 1970, if you told one of those artists that you could still have a career in 1970 at 75 years old, that it was still viable to have a career as a rock artist, they'd say you're crazy. Now we see McCartney and all these guys, and you know, Mick Jagger still up there and Keith Richards. So it's very feasible that we could be, if he had lived, that we could have been talking about a Hendrix tour right now, right?
Oh, yeah, I think
absolutely.
So. I mean, he lived for music. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he didn't have a Graceland, man. He didn't have 100 cars. He didn't live that life. He had a 2-bedroom apartment. The first huge money he made, he bought a recording studio.
Yeah.
So, and it's funny, Electric Lady is still going today. So he, even if he never made another record and still owned the studio, he'd have a comfortable life.
Yeah. Go ahead, Eddie. You want to say something?
No, I was just going to say, I think if Jimi Hendrix had lived, I'm fairly positive in the way I remember him. He was so into movies, into TV, into publishing, into songwriting. I think he would have owned his own record company. I think he would have a film company. He would have been one of those big stars, like a Jay-Z, owning all of that stuff, but directing it from his house in Maui.
not a bad plan. And the last thing. More stuff coming down the pike? Are we still turning over stones?
This is the last of the best of the studio stuff. We certainly have some exciting live things and some other kind of thematic releases that will come in the future. But, you know, Valleys of Neptune, People, Hell, and Angels, and Both Sides of the Sky, that was our attempt to kind of say, here's the very best of the really good studio stuff that Jimmy left us. And, you know, I think, as I say, going forward, it'll be cool stuff, but different from that.
And videos? Any more video?
Yeah.
Any more film?
No, without question. Yeah. We're working on some things right now. So,
nothing you can tell us?
No, I mean, certainly, you know, Jimmy's Maui performance is a legendary performance, and we've made a story about how, you know, he had nothing to do with Rainbow Bridge, but somehow that wacky movie came out and he got shoehorned into it. We're kind of, you know, pulling that apart and just actually showing the Hendrix portion of it and, you know, the fact that he really enjoyed doing it.
And Eddie, I know I keep saying last thing, but one last thing for me about Hendrix. So much is made of his playing, and rightfully so. But the one something that I love so much about Hendrix, and especially watching some of these live films that have come out and the concerts and things, was his singing. I love his voice. And sometimes I think because of his stellar playing, not enough people talk about his voice. I love his singing. What was it like recording him as a vocalist?
I loved his singing too, and many, many people do. He hated his voice, by the way.
Really?
He thought he had the worst voice in the world, and he was so shy about it. I used to make, you know, looking out from the control room, I made a set of screens, three-sided screens with the back facing the control room so nobody would see him. I'd turn all the lights down, give him just one little tiny light and a music stand for the lyrics, and shut all the lights off and record his voice. And he'd say, how was that? I was like, yeah, it's good, Jimmy, it's great. I'll do it again. And we kept doing stuff again because he was a perfectionist. He was shy about his voice, which was so crazy when you think about it. It was the most amazing song stylist.
Yeah.
And it's such a unique voice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible that he would do a lot of takes with him vocally because he would want to keep redoing it.
And later on when we had 16 track, I would just be punching in and out and then just sort of making a composite with him. Yeah, I like that line, I like that line. That was before even computers.
Well, that's incredible because it doesn't sound like that at all. That's the magic of Eddie Kramer, ladies and gentlemen.
That it
stop
is. It.
There you go.
Stop it.
The album is called Both Sides of the Sky, and again, 10 previously unreleased tracks, 13 in total from, of course, the late, great Jimi Hendrix, which we've been talking about, and the two gentlemen joining me, John McDermott, the catalog manager, and Eddie Kramer, the engineer on all of this material. Guys, it's great to see you, and on behalf of all the Hendrix fans, thank you for all you do for the legacy and keeping this thing alive, because it's, you can tell there's a lot of love that goes into it. And I'm sure for both of you, I mean, it's a bittersweet yet something you're very proud of, being able to carry this all forward,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Guys, the greatest. Thank you, Eddie.
Thank you, guys. Great to see you. And Mr. Kramer, you and I are going to get into it one day. We're going to do the full 2 hours. This Is Your Life, Eddie Kramer, is coming. Trust me, we're going to do that soon enough. We've been threatening it for a while, but we're going to get to it. So next time I'm up in Toronto where you are, we're going to make that happen. Well, my thanks to Eddie Kramer and John McDermott for a fascinating interview. Check out the new Hendrix record, which is out there right now. And I look forward to doing a full-length interview with Eddie Kramer about his entire career in the very near future. Also great to have John McDermott in with his insights about Jimi Hendrix as well. Thanks earlier to Michael Schenker, who was our guest on the Eddie Trunk podcast this week as well. Remember, follow me on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Please check out eddietrunk.com. The homepage has all my appearances, music news, the blog, which is the Trunk Report, signed copies of my books, merch, all sorts of stuff. Have a look when you get a chance. And if you're in the Dallas area, don't forget I'm doing my speaking show March 29th at the Guitar Sanctuary in McKinney, Texas. Going to be doing live Stump the Trunk, Q&A, maybe some musical performances, free beer with the price of the ticket. Buy the tickets. The link is right on the homepage of my site. Or if you're in the McKinney area, get them on the Guitar Sanctuary site. Wherever you get them, hope to see you in McKinney, Texas. Next up, March 29th at the Guitar Sanctuary. Haven't done a show there in a while. Always a great turnout. Always a great time. Hope to see you for what should be a great night. And did I mention tickets come with free beer? Hope to see you guys there. Thanks to Katie Irizarry. She is the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast. I will see you next Thursday for another all new episode, free as usual, on iTunes or podcastone.com.
Every Monday, get your weekly dose of Jay Moore on More Stories. This week's guest, Heather Graham. You know, Roller Girl.
Who's your favorite Muppet? Like, from Sesame Street all the way out
Kermit.
All right, front man.
Yeah.
Good.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows?
Amazing.
Well, it's such a good song, right?
It really is. Yeah. Jim Henson's probably like the greatest actor that ever lived.
Make sure you subscribe to More Stories exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, or the new Podcast One app. Don't forget to rate, review, and leave a 5-star rating.